Welcome to Father Harry from Carmen, Alabama. We just read step 12. Practice these principles in all of our affairs. You just heard that man lie. I did not tell him that pitiful story. My name is Harry Draper, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. Good evening. Now that tells you who I am and what I am. And when the two of us got up this morning, the who said to the what, we ain't going to take a drink today. And that's the way it's been all day long. But it didn't used to be that way. It used to be that we got up, and the who said to the what, we ain't going to take a drink today. And the what would say to the who said so? And the who would say, I said so. And the what would say, just you wait and see. And the what would get drunk and the who would have the hangover. Now that's worth telling. Let me mind my manners and thank the wonderful group of Davis for asking me to come out and help celebrate your 21st birthday. I realize that this is a first-class group. When Bob told me last night that you won't show up, whether you were celebrating 24, 23, 22, or 21. That's my kind of group, you see. They're real mixed up. My home group doesn't know its birthday either. And so I'm really grateful for anybody who had anything to do with bringing me out here. It's a long trip, and I've got to go home tomorrow morning because I'm still working. And I have to be on the job on Monday, but I will carry fond thoughts of Davis, of the Davisville, Davis, in my mind. I want to thank Bob and his lovely wife, Jackie, for their splendid hospitality. They certainly have been kind to me. And now we've got all that out of the way. In the big book, which is our program, on the first page of chapter 11, bear with me while I read two paragraphs. I meant to bring my own book. It falls open at the right places. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. And a feeling that life is good. Oh. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. Thank God I thought I was in the wrong book. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself, as we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm. The chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion. And the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. And my function tonight is to share with you my experience, my strength and hope, to show you how my terror has turned into joy, how my bewilderment has turned into certainty, how my frustration has turned into satisfaction and accomplishment, and how my despair has turned into hope. That's what I've got to do. And I'm supposed to do it by telling you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. Well, here we go. That's all I've got to say. Let me set this thing out so I'll know what time I better shut up. It seems to me, maybe it's just my nervousness, that somebody has turned off the air conditioning. And if they had, I wish they'd turn it back on. I'll tell you that. But maybe it's just me. I don't know. But you see, AA has taught me something. It's taught me that serenity prayer. It says, to accept the things I cannot change, to change the things I can, and the grace to know the difference. And I don't have to sit up here and sweat. I can fan. And if that bothers you, that's just your problem. It's not mine. That's true when you really think about it. I was born at a very early age in a good Christian home. I've heard so many drunks say that I'm not sure it's anywhere to raise children anymore. But I was, and it was a Catholic home in Mobile, Alabama. And drinking was just simply part and parcel of our way of life. You know, in the East, they say alcoholism is a disease contracted by Roman Catholics and treated in the basements of Methodist churches. I'm here to tell you that there's a lot of Baptists who are in our program in Alabama. And we're glad to have them, of course. But for us Catholics, drinking is just part of living. It goes with the sacramental system. We had drinks for baptisms. We had drinks for first holy communions. We had drinks for confirmations. We had drinks for weddings. We had drinks for ordinations. We had drinks for funerals. The only thing we didn't have drinks for was the going to confession. And some of us had to have a few drinks to steady our nerves to get ready to go to confession. And so, you see, I was not brought up in a household that thought drinking was seriously sinful. We did not. Now, make no mistake about it. We Catholics think getting drunk is seriously morally wrong, just like the Methodists and some of the Baptists do. But I cannot tell you when I had my first drink. It was always there. Not that we drank every day. We didn't. But for all the religious feast days, anytime there was company, there was drink. I can't tell you when I had my first drink. I can remember you were there with everybody, and there would be a little wine left in the glass. They'd fill it up with cold water, and you could have a glass just like the big people, or a swallower of beer. I do remember this. While I cannot remember when I had my first drink, I remember that I liked it from the very first time I ever had it. That it was connected with conviviality, companionship, hot dog, let's go. And it seemed to do more for me. The big book tells us that we alcoholics drink because we like the effects of drinking. Yes. You know, I hate to tell you this because I haven't told all these things. I'm getting more honest. It's not that I'm dishonest. I just can't tell everything in the time limit that's given. But I remember when I was an altar boy in the church. You know, a little kid, 12, 18 years old. And in the sacrifice of the Mass, our big church service, they use wine because they believe Christ used wine. But they have a little cruet. It's about 2 ounces, you know. And the wine that we had was so horrible, the priest would take it and shudder, you know. But when you went over with Mass, they never used the whole thing. But you couldn't put it back in the wine bottle because it might sour the whole bottle. And to throw it out, that was a waste. So what do you think the intelligent altar boy did with it? Yeah, you know. And I hate to tell this, but I can still remember the effect of that small amount of wine on a kid 12 years old. I suddenly was a foot off the pavement. And I could walk home and never touch the curbs. It was only 3 blocks by the time I got home. It was all over with, you see. But some of you will remember what I'm talking about, I'm sure. And there it is. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't know what that meant. I know today from the big book what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is a man or a woman of any shape, size, age, doesn't matter, who drinks and gets in trouble because he drinks. Who drinks and gets in trouble because she drinks. Who drinks Now, you can get into trouble for other things besides drinking. But if I got into as much trouble from eating watermelon as I did the last 3 years of my drinking, I'd have quit drinking a long time ago, or at least eating watermelon. If you want another definition of the alcoholic, an alcoholic is a person who, after he takes the first drink, you can no longer foretell with any certainty what he's going to do. He may take two drinks, go home, get up the next morning, go to work, or he may disappear for a month. There is no telling. You cannot prophesy with that. That's what alcoholism is. I told you that it was in our house all the time. I had a great big relationship. I had six aunts and one adopted, and they had their own population explosion. All of them built like ice cream cones, you know the type. And all married to little bitty men. That was a funny thing, you know. But we had one uncle, called him Harry. He was kind of the leader and had to face that tribe whenever we had weddings or funerals. And in order to get ready to face that number of relatives, Uncle Harry was always taking one more drink to steady his nerves. The only thing he'd get so steady, he couldn't move. And the other uncles would have to carry him home. Well, now, I can remember my mother saying to us kids the next morning, "Now, you saw Uncle Harry. If that's the way drinking affects you, you don't drink. But you saw all the rest of your uncles and aunts, perfect ladies and gentlemen. Do you see? It couldn't be said of anybody that he had an education how to drink like a gentleman. It should have been me. Yeah. And I end up an alcoholic. I think I want to say at this time, my father was dead when I was 3 or 4 years old. I know today I resented God for that. I really did. Now, there are many people who lose a parent early in life. They'll make a federal case out of it. But I think many of my relatives said, "Poor child, he doesn't have a daddy." And they set me on the pity pot, and I just ate it up. I kept it going. You know, "Poor child, he doesn't have a daddy." I had a marvelous grandfather who was the male image in my life, thank God, and a splendid mother. But I really, it wasn't the same. I did not have a father. And I know today I really resented God for that. I was not a well-adjusted kid. I was one of the kids, you know how when they're choosing up size to play ball, there are always one or two that don't get chosen. Well, you take those two and we'll take him. You know. And I'm not well coordinated to this day. I can't put light bulbs in sockets. I have to call the electric company. I was not a good athlete. I was a good student. But I always wanted to be something that I wasn't. I think that's a crucial issue. At least for me it is. I was not a well-adjusted kid. I developed all right. And I learned how at an early age to be a people pleaser. It's very simple. You do what they tell you, and then you do what you want. But you notice the hypocrisy which is coming in there, you see? And I'm always getting my way. I'm King Baby. I was King Baby up until I was 45 years old, got to this program, and learned how to start to be an adult. But it was my childhood. Well, when I was 15 years old, my mother thought I needed more men in my education. And I say she sold me up the river from Mobile, Alabama, to the tender mercies of the Benedictine monks at Coleman, and I never got away. I had a terrible time adjusting to boarding school, believe me. But I did get in with some of the local families, boys in my class, and every housewife worth the name at that time, that was back in the 30s in Coleman, Alabama, knew how to squeeze the grape and make that German-type grape juice. And they did it with Coleman County strawberries. And I know I'm out here in California, but I got to tell you all something about wine making. If you have not tasted Coleman County strawberry wine before you got into AA, you're just going to have to wait till you get to heaven. I'm telling you, the most glorious color of red I ever saw in my life. It's a distinctive red. It just comes in Coleman County strawberry wine. And an aroma, when you took the cork out the bottle, you could smell it the block away. And a kick like the proverbial Missouri mule, you know. But you're in no trouble. You're in somebody's home, small glass homemade wine, piece of cake, fine. But I liked it. It meant so much more to me. In 41, I decided I loved everything about Coleman and St. Bernard and the monks. I asked if I could be one. And they said I could try. And so in June of 41, I became a rookie monk. And after you got into the monastery, they began to let you in on the 33rd degree secrets. And among the most carefully kept of these secrets was the fact that the monks were not about to be outdone by the housewives of Coleman. And they too knew how to squeeze that grape and make that German-type grape juice. And they made a little homebrew on the side. You talk about a revelation to the Gentiles. Glory be to God. 19 years old. The monks did not drink every day. Feast days, for an hour after Vespers, if you know the German word, Gemütlichkeit, they'd come together for sandwiches, cigars, homebrew, homemade wine, pink lemonade for the panty waist, you know. But looking back, I can see the characteristics that they describe in the big book. It always meant more to me. I was always the first one there and the last one to leave. I was always figuring out, when's it going to happen again? You know, 19 years old, and I've already developed my habits of drinking. By the time I was 19 years old, there were only two things that ever made me quit drinking once I started. Either there was nothing left to drink, or I was too sick to drink it. And believe me, those are not normal drinking patterns. Those are not normal patterns. But I know they told me they weren't normal, and I didn't get in any trouble, and nothing was happening. I just had a great time. Except comes Christmas, and we're having a party, and I go into a blackout. Now, in case there may be some of you all who don't know the difference, I'm going to tell you. You can drink and drink and drink and drink and drink, and the body, in order to save its own life, will short-circuit some of the systems. You will go unconscious, and you slide under the table, and there you stay until the next morning until somebody carries you home. That is passing out. And I have passed out, too. But in blacking out, you drink and drink and drink, and again the body, to save its own life, short-circuit some of the systems. This time you go into, quote, temporary amnesia, unquote. You continue to function, quote, normally, quote, but you don't remember it. And for some of you Al-Anons, you're saying to your alcoholic, where were you last night? He says, I don't know. And she says, quit lying. He may not be lying. He may not have the foggiest clue of where he was. And you say, who were you with? He said, I don't know. He said, lying again. We alcoholics have got evidence, conclusive, of this phenomenon. Of this phenomenon. We know, for example, of cases where Army people have signed out airplanes in Atlanta, flown all the way to San Francisco, went in the officer's bar, had a few more drinks, flew back to Atlanta, checked in, and would never know that they would gone if they hadn't seen the flight plans. That's scary. And the reason I take time to tell you that is because if you have experienced what I have just described, that is almost a Satan sign that you are a little bit pregnant. Now, I use that advisedly because there's no such thing as being a little bit pregnant. You either are or you aren't. And if you have experienced a blackout, then you are most likely across that line. And I suggest that maybe some of you ought to move your letters over from the Al-Anon room to the AA room. Yeah, think about it. There I am experiencing a blackout, 19 years old. I don't know anything about it. The next day when it dawns on me that I've had this phenomenon, and I'm trying to figure out what happened, I don't tell anybody. I don't discuss it with anybody. Because I think, in truth, that I knew way, way back in the back of my mind that it was drinking, that it was alcohol that caused that. But at that time, I loved everything about alcohol. Everything. To such an extent that I was not about to admit that anything I loved that much could hurt me. But I had to have a reason. What caused that loss of memory? What caused that phenomenon? And after I considered it with Aristotelian Thomistic philosophical principles, I came up to the conclusion that it was the cheese. Now, isn't that stupid? You know, we say alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Alcoholics are cunning, baffling, and powerful. Everybody knows he's an alcoholic. His wife knows it. His children know it. His boss knows it. His doctor knows it. His dog knows it. But he doesn't know he's an alcoholic. At least he won't admit it. He's the last one to admit it. He's the last one. And you see, I said to myself for years, I can quit drinking any time I want to. And people kept saying to me, well, why in the hell don't you want to? You sure ought to. You see? And the horrible thing is, this disease of alcoholism, if you cross that invisible line between controlled and uncontrolled drinking, it's progressive. And that means it's not going to get better unless there is some definite intervention, unless something happens. If we keep on drinking, the greatest thing that can end up, the most careful thing is for us to end up dead drunk, in the literal meaning of those two words. That's the best thing that can happen to us. We can end up in custodial care. Now, I don't know where they do it in California, but in Alabama, they send you down to Tuscaloosa, and it's not to go to the university. Custodial care. Or you quit. And the horrible thing for me is that when I finally got to the point that I knew I had to quit, and I wanted desperately to quit, I discovered to my terror, my frustration, my bewilderment, my despair, I could not. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I never set out to be drunk in my life. Never. But in the last years of my drinking, I always ended up drunk. I always ended up drunk. I would say it's going to be different this time. And it was different. Every time it was worse. But at any rate, in 47, I was ordained a priest. And believe me, by that time, I think I'm across the line. But if it was obvious that I was an alcoholic, Archbishop Tulin would never have ordained me a priest. The Catholic Church has got enough trouble without ordaining drunk monks. I was teaching in a very fancy prep school we had at that time, associate principal, drinking just like a fish, anytime I could, as long as I could. We had a new boss. I was convinced that they couldn't run that school without me. The first thing the new boss did was to write me a letter and put it under my door. We were living in the same house, but we weren't communicating very well. And that letter said, go to Barberville, Kentucky, and take Father Timothy's place. We need him home to teach philosophy. And I said to somebody, where in the Lord's holy name is Barberville, Kentucky? And some wag of a monk says, you go to hell, turn right, and walk 3 miles. He was wrong. It was only 2 miles. The Cumberland Gap area, where Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee come together. Real disaster. Oh, Lord have mercy. And that was in the 50s. Floods every other year. Water up to the stations in the church. Rowing around the church with a rowboat. You had to drink to live in that place. I'm telling you. The first morning I was there, we had said Mass, and Father Timothy, God rest his soul, said to me, you take your meals next door in Aunt Sally Coon's house. That's whenever you're home. So we go to Aunt Sally Coon's. 4-room house. Aunt Sally belongs to the Lottie Moon Cycle. Uncle Albert, her husband, is a Catholic. He's a retired miner. We were at the breakfast table in the kitchen, hot, oh Lord, no air conditioning. Uncle Albert, beautiful in his 60s, me and Father Timothy. Out here was, at this end, was Uncle Albert's son, a 30 years old, a state trooper. All he had on was a pair of shorts. His two kids, 17, 16. I never saw a lady sit at that table the whole time I was there. Well, conversation was difficult. And I was picked up a water glass, all beaded, and I took two great big swallows. Well, you've seen the atomic bomb blasts. There was this roaring in my ears. There were these lights flashing in my eyes. I couldn't see. I couldn't hear. The whole room was shaking. My hair stood straight up on the back of my neck. And, you know, I'm convinced to this day that if I had not been an alcoholic, I would have screamed bloody murder. But what I do is hang on tight till the tremors pass. I'm telling you the truth. I'm not making this up. And when I can see again, Uncle Albert's got one. Timothy's got one. The trooper's got one. The kids haven't got it. Well, after breakfast, we were stepping high over the weeds going back to the church. And I said to Father Timothy, in the Lord's holy name, what was in that water glass? He said, moonshine, 120 proof. I said, for breakfast? He says, anytime you can get it. Do I have to tell you that Timothy joined me in this program about a year after I did? And he's gone to heaven. Oh, he was a glorious man. But what a wonderful place to send a budding alcoholic. You know, and I bloomed. I said, I don't get into any trouble. I'm there 5 years. But I think it's there that I really put the coffin nails into my alcoholism. I don't get arrested. But the truth of the matter is, as you know, if you're an alcoholic, serious alcoholic drinking takes time. It takes a lot of time. And that's why when we get into this marvelous program of AA, we've got to put time into this program. That we've got to go to the meetings, we've got to read the books, we've got to work with other drunks, There's a whole lot of things we've got to do to fill up that time that we used to drink. I went back to the college 5 years later as a dean. By this time, I'm hooked. I got to have it. I got to have it where I can look at it and read the labels and shake the bottles and look at the frog eyes, you know. I don't have to drink it every day, but I got to have it there. Why? Well, in case of snake bite, or if I want to celebrate Hungarian Freedom Fighters Day, you know. And the pattern's the same. Once I start, I don't quit. Not until there's nothing left or I'm too sick to drink it. These terrible personality clashes are coming up again with the boss. Now, you can have personality clashes for many things with people. And if you've got enough goodwill, you can get over them. But if alcohol's in the picture, you're not going to handle anything until you handle the alcohol. By this time, the old man knows that I'm in drinking too much. But if he'd said one word to me about it, I'd have been on him like a bee on a bulldog. I said, what you talking about, me drinking too much? I'm teaching 5 classes a day. I'm running the whole school over here. Why don't you get a hold of some of these bums? They're not doing a blessed thing. But that wasn't the truth. I wasn't doing the job I could have been doing if I wasn't drinking alcoholically. But he doesn't face me with it. What he does is give me another geographical cure removal before I know what that is, you see. This time I get another letter which says, go to the Delta of the Mississippi. Now, if you all think that's in southwest Louisiana, you are mistaken. As Faulkner says, it begins in the lobby of the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. And it goes down the river 40 miles on the Mississippi side, 20 miles on the Arkansas side, and you come to Yazoo City. And if you all haven't been in that part of the South, you don't know what the South is all about. Those people do not know the Civil War was lost. They don't even know it was fought and could not care less. It's down around Alligator. There are no farmers down there. They're all planters. I'm telling you, drinking is a way of life. Oh, Lord, have mercy. And this was the 60s, the long, hot, dry summers. I hate to tell this because I don't know whether the law can still get them. But they were selling whiskey in Mississippi. When Mississippi was a completely dry state, they had to bootleg the federal stamps from Alabama to put on the illegal whiskey they were selling in Mississippi. Now, I'm not going to tell you how I got all I needed to drink. That's none of your business. Every good alcoholic has his ways and means. There's no way. But when I got to Mississippi, I thought I had come to paradise. I could pick up the telephone. Well, before I should tell you, I had this terrible syndrome of saving empty whiskey bottles. Did anybody else do that besides me? Every time I opened the closet, it was full of empty whiskey bottles. And I would say, somebody's putting those in there. I couldn't have drunk that much whiskey. You know, normal drinkers finish a bottle of whiskey and throw the empty bottle away. Not me. I had to save them. For what? I don't know. But here I was in Mississippi. I could pick up the phone and say, Mamie. And she'd say, be right there, Father. Now, when I tell you that, Father Malachy says, to be sure you know that Mamie was the bootlegger. You're a little slow tonight. And Mamie would come, take the dead soldiers out, give them decent Christian burial, put in new recruits, and send you a bill at the end of the month. Had it made in the shade. I'm telling you, it was glorious. I never had, except, just like the big book says, I was coming apart at the seams. This alcoholism will take everything you've got. And we can chart it. The alcoholic, if he drinks long enough, comes apart. He comes apart spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and finally he comes apart physically. He can't walk anymore. He's crawling. And I was beginning to come apart. Coming apart spiritually. I was supposed to be a minister. I was supposed to be a man of God. I was supposed to be standing in the pulpit telling other people how to run their lives. I couldn't stand to look at myself. In the mirror, I couldn't stand it. There's something wrong. You're not supposed to be getting drunk. Every time you turn around, you're getting drunk. It was horrible. And if I confided into other priests, they'd say, pray more. Pray. Lord, I was praying. You know the prayer. I used to know how to pray, but in the last stages of my alcoholism, the only prayer I knew was, dear God, get me out of this one. I'll never do it again. And as Jimmy says, hey, Father, your God ain't no horse trader. He don't need your damn horses. Do you understand that? Do you see what I'm talking about? horrible things. I was becoming to come apart emotionally. I couldn't remember. You know, what did you say? Why aren't those people talking to you? What commitments have you made? How about this one? Where did you put the automobile? Where is the car? It's not yours. It belongs to the parish. We want the automobile. It costs $10,000. Where is the car? I don't know where the car is. Did you leave it in Memphis? I don't know. Oh, you can laugh today, but it wasn't a bit funny then. Jesus, Mary and Joseph. Lord, have mercy on my poor soul. Well, it was beginning to show. You know, you can't hide it forever. People find out about it. It was beginning to show, and priests were talking to me and saying, Father Hillary, you got a problem. You better watch out. Things are going to get bad. We had a new boss at Coleman. He came from Minnesota. Dumb. Yankee. Didn't know a thing about the South. Came down to save us. And I have to tell you that he's still alive today, and he did become my Savior. And I love him today more than I love any other man in the whole wide world. But at that time, he came over to Mississippi to see me, and I thought, oh, God, somebody's been snitching. He's coming over here to read me the riot act. But no. His aide-de-camp was with him, and I said, what the boss want? Oh, he said, didn't he talk to you last night? I said, no. He said, well, you've been nominated as seventh president of St. Bernard College. And as chairman of the board, he said before he acted on the nomination, he thought he ought to come over and interview you. And he told me last night when we were going to bed that he was well satisfied and he was... And I got the knock. I got the bed. Now, pay attention. This towering ego, which is the alcoholic personality, it's still there. Any sane man with what I've just described to you being offered the presidency of a college would have said, no, I cannot accept that kind of responsibility. It's too much. What does the alcoholic say? Certainly I'll accept that. You don't think they'd be offering me the job as president of the college if I was a drunk? That'll show these people whether or not I'm an alcoholic. Whom I choose to call higher power. Because of this marvelous program of the 12 steps, because of people just like you and many of you people, I've been able to make amends, and I can go back to Mississippi today and hold up my head. And for that, I'm everlastingly grateful. But I had one more episode to run. I came home as president of the college, and in 3 years, everything that happened already to me as an alcoholic happened. I remember coming home and saying I had read in a psychology book that said, you cannot get drunk on beer. I thought, now that's it. From now on, all I'm going to do is drink beer. And you know what? I wrote the man who wrote that article a letter. He never answered it. But in that letter, I told him that I didn't know where he got that information. That as far as I was concerned, I could get just as drunk on beer as on whiskey. It took longer. I had to stay closer to a commode. That's the truth. He never answered. I didn't stay with that beer diet very long. You know, I've heard alcoholics say they've been in jail in every county in every state in the Union. I've only been in one. I never want to go again. Oh, Lord. It's etched in my mind. I woke up. I have a horrible characteristic of waking up at 3 a.m. I did last night, 3 o'clock. And this morning I woke up at 3 o'clock and I thought, where am I? I was dressed up. I said, that's a funny bed I'm on. It doesn't have any mattress. Oh, I see some of you recognize it. No pillows. When I get my eyes open, get to the windows, it's got bars on it. And I thought, oh, Lord, you played hell this time. I resented the people that built that jail. Because the way they built it, I could not tell if I was in Mobile, New Orleans, Montgomery, Atlanta, Nashville, Memphis, or Rome, Italy. And I didn't know how I got there. Now, I'm going to tell you something else that I don't generally tell everybody. I don't have time, but I'll tell you that tonight because I'm feeling good. I don't know about California, but every little town in Alabama, or Georgia for that matter, or Mississippi, little bitty towns, they've always got some Catholic in that town who is the Catholic Church. And no matter what happens, they call up Miss Mamie or Mr. Frank and say, you know, what do we do? There's a leak in the church or whatever. Somebody robbed it. Well,
here I am in jail, and the police call up Mr. Frank. And they say, we got a Catholic priest in jail down here, Mr. Frank. What you want to do with him? And Mr. Frank says, who is it? Said, well, on the license it says Hillary Bernard Draper from Coleman. And Mr. Frank says, leave him in jail. I'll get him in the morning. Well, now I want you to understand this, that I would just have shown him, I would rather have seen Pope John Paul II than to have seen Mr. Frank that next morning when they took me out of the jail cell and took me down to the desk. Because guess who Mr. Frank was? Mr. Frank was the chairman of the board of governors of the Hotshot College of which I was president. And if there's any man I did not want to see, it was Frank. Here's Frank fishing his Hotshot president out of the drunk tank. But again, we are cunning, baffling, powerful. We turn people into our neighbors. Frank said to me, Father, this is terrible. We got to do something about this. You need help. I said, oh, no, Frank. I was just out of the country club and got too much cheese. Now, I'm in the car is wrecked. I'm all beat up. I'm in the jail, and I said, it's because of the cheese. And I convinced Frank that it wouldn't happen again. And he doesn't ring the bell on me. There was one more year to go. Horrors, horrors, horrors. And finally, in January, December it was, I forget, 67, I'm supposed to make a speech in front of all the important people of the college community. The 50 monks, the 30 or 40 lay teachers, the faculty senate, the Student Government Association, the Board of Governors, the Board of Trustees, a big dinner, and I'm supposed to make a speech on the State of the Union. And I made that speech that night. I made it. But the Lord's truth is, the last thing I remember that day was 4:30 in the afternoon, and I was taking one more drink to steady my nerves. And at 4:30, I went into a blackout. And I stayed in that blackout till the next morning at 6:30. I made that speech. And when I tell you that, I can really begin to sweat and shake. Because I can have some idea of what it must have been like for those fine people to sit there and watch and listen to the obviously drunken Catholic priest. You talk about a bottom. I figuratively slit my throat from ear to ear. The next morning I noticed the atmosphere was a little cool on the campus. But of course, you know, like the alcoholic, you know, it's all right. The wind's quit blowing. 3 or 4 days later, I'm in the chancellor's office throwing dust, date usual. And he finishes listening to me and he says, sit down. I sit down. He says, I want to say one thing to you. We've had a meeting of the board of trustees. There's only one thing on the agenda, namely your resignation. Sign here. It's effective right now. And he proceeded to read me the riot act in 3 or 4 gorgeous technicolor scenes. About what a disgrace I was to my own name, my own family name, how I had dragged the name of the college through the mud of drunkenness, what scandal I had given. See, he doesn't even know the word alcoholism. And he tells me that I'm a perfect disgrace to the priesthood, to everything. And that from there on, get out. They do not want me, and they don't intend to put up with me anymore. To get out. Now, I don't know whether I can make you understand that, but to that day, the two things that I loved the most, namely the priesthood and St. Bernard, were gone. And there wasn't any way that I knew that they could ever come back again. The old man said, I wish you'd go somewhere and get some help with your drinking problem. Notice he doesn't even know the word alcoholism. But he says, if you won't, I'll help you get a job anywhere else in the country. You're a good teacher. If I had taken that second alternative, ladies and gentlemen, I do not believe I would have been here tonight. I believe that burden of guilt would have been so terrible, I'd have been back into the bottle. I would have been insane or dead by this time. That higher power was watching out for me, and I think because of all the Al-Anon type people who love me so much and do nothing to do for me but pray, that I said yes, I would go anywheres and do anything to try to get some help with my drinking problem. The old man had heard of a place called Hazelden up in the cold wilds of Minnesota who had a reputation for doing something good for people who were bad to drink. And on January 14, 1968, I arrived in Hazelden, Minnesota with a temperature 50 degrees below zero and a wind chill factor that made it 80 below. And I was just out of Alabama and I nearly froze to death. I figured these people had to drink just to stay alive. At that time, Hazelden was a 3 weeks program. And I remember very well, I was so scared I didn't have any drinks when I arrived at Hazelden. I wasn't sober, I was dry. And the first morning I was there, I went to see the counselor. They took me to see the counselor. And I hate to tell this because it's going to be recounted, but I'm just telling you the truth. That counselor looked at me and he says, "Now, Father Hillary, it's the last time we're going to call you Father Hillary because you ain't nothing but a goddamn drunk." You know, I was going to write the ad and say, "Hey, you sent me up here with blasphemers, not only profaners." He says, "There you are sitting with that Roman collar and that black dickie on. You got no right to wear them. Take them off." Do you see? Do you see the tiring ear? Do you see the hypocrisy? Something that I had no right to wear this. And there I was in a drunk tank. All dressed up. Oh, Lord. And they didn't call me Father. They wouldn't. No. And then they said, "Don't plan on 3 weeks to get this program." I said, "Of course not. I reckon I'll get it in 2. Now, I'm not proud of that, but that's true. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, no." He said, "We find for doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, undertakers, professors, college teachers, presidents, it takes 3 and 4 times as long to get this simple program." And I said, "Why?" They said, "Because you all keep up such a dreadful front. It takes a long time to get behind there and find out where the real Hillary lives." And they were right. All they did is they had 3 meetings a day, morning, afternoon, and night, 1 hour at a time, when they went through the 12 steps. And then they had 2 or 3 meetings a week when they tried to get you to face yourself, smaller meetings. At the time they took me in, they gave me this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a lie. They sold it to me. And they said, "Read it." Well, the first thing I did was to open it up and see if it was approved by a Catholic bishop. And it wasn't. And I said, "Huh. It most likely was printed in Memphis or Nashville, Tennessee, and it's foot washing Baptist literature, and they're not going to brainwash me." Now, I'm not proud of that, but that is, I would not read this thing. Now, let me try and tell you what that was. Y'all know the little 24-hour-a-day book? You know that. Well, they gave us that, sold it to us. I loved that. It didn't have any imprimatur from a Catholic bishop. I read that faithfully every day, but I wouldn't touch this thing. No, sir. Now, they made us go to the meetings. I had to. I'm a great believer in going to meetings. After I had been there about 5 weeks, it became apparent to my cunning alcoholic brain that the people who were getting out of Hazelden were taking, working, doing steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And if I didn't take steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I was going to be in Hazelden with Gabriel Blue with horns. And I decided I didn't want to stay that long. So one night I sat up the whole night and read the first 167 pages. Now, I've been there at least 5 weeks, at least. So think of, you know, I've heard everything there is to hear. I read it. I couldn't wait for breakfast. I shot down to the counselor's room and I said, "I've got step 1. My life's unmanageable. I'm powerless over alcohol." He says, "You ain't got nothing. Get back." I said, "I have got step 1. I'm an alcoholic. I'm powerless. My life." He says, "You are loaded with resentments." I said, "I don't resent anybody." You know, he was right. See, I resented God. I resented the bishop. I resented the abbot. I resented all the monks of St. Bernard. I resented all the teachers in the college. He was right. I was loaded with resentments. I was just loaded and didn't even know it. Didn't even know it. Well, I can't remember anymore. I believe I was there 9 or 10 weeks. I finally got through the first 5 steps to the best of my ability. I told you that I went into treatment on January the 14th. I did not get back to Cullman. You said I didn't think I would ever be able to get back to Cullman. But they said in Hazelden, "Now, when you go back to Cullman, if you admit you're an alcoholic, you're going to tell people you're an alcoholic. The disease." I said, "Of course not. That's the dumbest thing I ever heard. You don't stay in the South. You don't run around with a big sign out, 'Watch out for me, I'm a tuberculosis.' No." And I said, "Furthermore, it's a silly question because I cannot go back to Cullman." And they said, "Why can't you go back to Cullman? Now, I've taken a 5th step. I said, "You know why I can't go back to Cullman? The man said, "Were you running around with women?" I said, "No." He said, "Did you embezzle the college's money?" I said, "No." Now, again, look at the honesty of this program. If I had been running around with women, maybe Coleman wouldn't have been the best place to send me back. If I had embezzled the college's money, maybe I couldn't go back. But he said, "You lost the job because of the disease of alcoholism. When are you going to quit running? When are you going to go back and face the situation?" I said, all right. "I'll go back. Now you convince them to let me come back." You see, because I'm not the first priest in Alabama who ever had problems with drinking. I am the first priest who ever got this blessed program. But in the past, if we had priests who were bad to drink, if somehow or another we could sober them up, we never let them return to the scene of the crime. We sent them to Louisiana, New Mexico, California. And in real bad cases, Honolulu. Go west, young man, go west. And here is AA saying to me, "You go back where you came from." And I got back to Coleman the 1st of September. I was in a halfway house. It wasn't deemed advisable for me to come right back. So some of you all take a long time to get back to some degree of normalcy. If it'll encourage you, it was January till September for me. And I came back home to Coleman, and I wish I could tell you it was like the prodigal son returning. It was not. If I had to describe what my homecoming was like, it was just like the way two porcupines make love. Carefully. You see, the monks never expected to see me back. And then all of a sudden, here's old hoop-de-doo. Here's old hallelujah. Come back, you know. And of course, they don't know what to expect. And the horrible thing is, I stayed a loner from September till January. I couldn't find you. You were so anonymous in Coleman. I couldn't find you. You weren't in the phone book. You did advertise in our weekly newspaper, but I never read that. Finally, a monk who, not an alcoholic, very dear to me, Father Luke, came up one day and he said, "For your information, AA is alive and well in Coleman. Here's the phone number. Call him up." He's not an alcoholic. He can find it. I can't find it. For 3 days, he said to me, "Did you call?" I said, "Yes." They don't answer. Now, he learned something about alcoholics. If you want the right answer, you've got to ask the right question. He says, "What time are you calling?" I said, "Midnight." I'm not proud of that. That's the truth. He said, "Call him now." I rang that telephone number, and I got my sponsor, Juby. And I said, "Mr. J, this is Father Hillary out to college. I'm an alcoholic. I need to go to an AA meeting." There was this long silence on the phone, and the first thing that man ever said to me in a gravelly voice was, "Father, are you drunk now?" Notice again the realism. I said, "No." But notice, that nothing else mattered. But he says, "Don't take a drink today. We have a meeting tonight at 8 o'clock. I'll be along at 7:30 to pick you up." Notice again, he doesn't tell me where the meeting is. He doesn't tell me to go. He says, "It's at 8 o'clock. I'll get you at 7:30. I said to him, "Fine. But don't come to the front door of the college. I'll meet you down on the road to the cemetery under the pine trees in the dark of the moon by the grot boat." You know, it's a wonder the man didn't say, "Hey, Father, when you want what we got, and we'll go to any length of you to call me back." But no, you come to Coleman, and I'll show you the road to the cemetery, the tall pine trees, the dark of the moon. But Juby came that night at 7:30, and I crept out from behind the stations to get in the car and go to my meeting. It's the same place, but it's vastly improved. It's over the pool room in Coleman Town. And when I went up those steps in January, the next 1969, I guess it was, when I went up those steps, the plaster was coming down off the ceiling. The wallpaper was rolling off the walls. It was about as big as that square over there. The one light naked bulb was hanging down. There was one nasty old sofa with the springs coming out. And there was about 12 people, and they all looked like foot washing Baptists at Church of Christ to me. And I thought, "Oh Lord, I'm in the wrong place for sure." Now don't be offended. That's the way it was. That's not the way it is today. We don't care what you are. You can handle snakes as far as we're concerned. If you want what we got, we are willing to give it to you. And we love you to death. But that's the way it was. My tyrant ego is still there. And I thought, "Oh Lord, if I can just get out of this, I'll never darken this place again. I'm in the wrong place for sure." And I'm standing outside the door. It's got a glass, and I'm looking through there. And while I'm there, Juby's disappeared. A good sponsor knows when to disappear. And while I'm standing there just beside myself, here comes this woman.
good looking, dressed up to the nines.
I had known her as a splendid Catholic matron from Decatur, about 30 miles up the line, and I had worked with her in church projects. I did not show she was an alcoholic. She walked up to me, and she said, "Hello, Father Hillary. If you need what we got, we're so glad you're here. Come on in, you're going to be all right." And she put her arm through my arm, and she mesmerized me right through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not know for 2 years that that was a put-up job, and she was a shill. You talking about knowing how to work a program. After I called Juvie, he called Decatur and said, "Rosemary, come to the meeting tonight in Coleman." She says, "I can't. I got my own meeting." He said, "You come on down here. I got a Catholic priest coming in. And I don't know a damn thing about Catholics, much less priests. You're a Catholic, and you get down here and you help me with him." And when the poor, stupid, drunken Catholic priest is trying to get through the doors of AA, there's Rosemary holding out the hand of AA. And when I tell you that, I shudder to think what my pride would have taken me to if that woman hadn't been there that night. I think I would have walked on my heel and gone away, and my pride would have put me right back in the bottle. But that woman was there, holding out the hand of AA. She's still in the program. She's in a wheelchair now. And that's 19 years ago, one day at a time. I tell you, I'll walk a long way for Rosemary. She has really been something for me. So there I was, in the Coleman group. In the Coleman group. And I have made every mistake that is possible to make in AA, except I've never taken another drink. I remember asking him in a closed meeting shortly, not too shortly, I said, "But I've been in the program now 2 years, dry, sober, and I want to know one thing. Why am I an alcoholic? With my splendid aristocratic background, if the truth were known, degenerate southern aristocracy, a tender loving God given to me, my tender loving people, I was a wanted child, I wasn't a surprise. What am I doing, an alcoholic?" And the great silence comes over the group. When everybody knows who's the answer, and they're going to wait to see who's going to zap the fool, you know. And finally, Juby says, "All hell, Father Hillary. It don't make no difference how the jackass got into the ditch. Just get him out." And then, now pay attention to this one. One time I asked her, I said, "I'm worried about this." I said, "What I want to know is, now that I'm sober, if I don't manage my own life, who's going to manage it?" I thought that'll get him. And again, this tremendous silence. And finally, Jesus says, "Well, Father, step three says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God. And step 10 or 11 says, sought through prayer and meditation." I said, "Shut up. Don't tell anybody I asked that question." Here I am, a trained theologian, and I have to go to the drunks to learn theology. And that's true. Everything that I have learned in living, I have learned from you all. The time is gone. I'm through. It has been a glorious experience as far as I'm concerned. Each day, there's only one thing that Alcoholics Anonymous ever told me that I found out was a lie. There's only one thing for me. They told me that the first year of my sobriety and my first birthday would be the happiest and the most glorious that I ever spent. That has not been true for me. What has been true for me is that each successive year that I am in this program, a day at a time, each successive birthday that I celebrate is more glorious than the one that went before. I've been on the pink cloud for 19 years. I see no reason whatsoever to come down. I have no intention to come down. As long as I can stay there, I'll stay right there. That doesn't mean I can't face reality. I certainly can. Let me bring this to a close by a quotation from page, I think it's 133, that a lot of people miss, and it's a beautiful situation, I think. It helps us to end it up easily. It's, no, that's not it. A word about sex relations, that's not it. Well, it looks like I can't find it. I'm sure it was 132. Oh, here it is. "We've been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We've been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect, but we aren't a glum lot
If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. Very important sentence. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. Page 132. Further down it says, so we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. And finally, on the top of page 133, we are sure that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. Thank you for listening to me.